Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's Fukushima irradiated, which is good, because everybody now has a part-time job as an eco-saver light bulb, which is good for the economy, according to the Prime Minister. And my very special guest is Carolyn Baker, coming at us live from the very, very chilly Colorado. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vinny. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
My pleasure having you. Now, kind of like a parent has a child. Now, would you mind explaining both to me and of course the audience who might not be 100% familiar with your work, just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I started back in 2000 researching world events, and I was very suspicious of the so-called election here in the United States in the year 2000, very suspicious of the 9/11 situation. And so I began researching, reading, doing some writing. I met a guy named Mike Rupert, who you may be familiar with, and started writing for his website. And in 2006, I was a professor of history, and I come from a background of training as a psychotherapist, but I was teaching history and psychology in college here in the U.S., and I wanted to put together a sort of a supplemental text for alternative history. I was very much in favor and fond of Howard Zinn's work, but I wanted to kind of take that a little further and make it more recent. So I published a book called U.S. History Uncensored, What Your High School Textbook Didn't Tell You. And then, you know, as I was researching all of these different things that were going on, you know, 9/11, peak oil, and the housing bubble that was taking place in the United States, the economic meltdown that was happening all over the world, I was looking at things and kind of, you know, this problem and that problem as sort of separate from each other. And then I began to realize in about 2007, after watching a documentary called What a Way to Go, Life at the End of Empire, I began to realize that we're looking at a whole syndrome that really has to do with the collapse of industrial civilization and the paradigm on which it's based. So the first thing I wondered, because I could go to websites and I could find all sorts of information about logistical preparation, how to store food and water and grow organic gardens and so forth, how are people going to prepare for this emotionally? How are they going to navigate this psychologically? So then I wrote a book called, in 2009, Sacred Demise, Walking the Spiritual Path of Industrial Civilization's Collapse. I expected to sell about 20 copies. You know, nobody wants to read this stuff. Well, it turns out it was fairly successful. And then I took it to the next level in 2011, and I wrote a book called Navigating the Coming Chaos, A Handbook for Inner Transition. That was a very successful book. And then just just last year, I published another book called Collapsing Consciously, Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times. Now, what's different about this book is what I did is I originally submitted a manuscript that had 17 essays and 365 daily reflections on collapse. And the publisher, North Atlantic Books, said this is wonderful, but we think it's going to be too big of a book. So why don't we take the 17 essays and you pull out 52 weekly reflections and we'll put that in a hard copy and then we'll put the other 313 reflections in an ebook. And so that's what they've done. And so all of these books are toolkits for emotional and spiritual preparation to help us get through what we're experiencing and also to inspire us to resist and to be activists.
There's something that happens to people that normally motivates them to go down a certain path, a path of perhaps in your case sort of higher consciousness, one might even say selflessness to a degree. What was that moment for you?
Just, I guess, a moment of truth in which everything that I was studying and looking at, I had to make a decision, and I think everyone does. At each point as you look at this, it gets worse and worse and worse, and you have to decide, am I going to go on? Am I going to really look at this? Or am I going to go back and pull the covers over my head and, you know, maybe smoke another joint or have another beer or whatever? And so I made a decision, as many people do, to just keep going. And I'm not sorry. I haven't looked back.
Yeah, it's almost like a lack of options to a degree, I'd say, or at least for me it was. Now, many people are concerned of the future. And I gave a quote to you before the broadcast today by Lao Tzu saying, if you are depressed, it's because you're living in the past. If you are anxious, it's because you're living in the future. And if you're at peace, you are living in the now. Can I make a postulation here? Because I've been listening to a lot of Patriot Talk Radio this last week that I've been off. And what I see so many of them doing is asking questions of experts, how bad is it going to get, when is it going to collapse, these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And that quote in context, it occurs to me that a lot of people are almost concerned enough to want to be anxious, to want to not be at peace by worrying about things that are not yet here and to not prepare themselves for it properly. Could you elucidate on that?
Sure. You know, I think if we could sit down with Mr. Lao Tzu and talk with him deeply, he would probably say, well, you know, basically the past, present, and future are all connected. It's very difficult to separate them. So for me, it's really important to understand how we got here, which is the past, and to look at what that could mean in the future. And then to be as present in current time, in the moment as possible, as grounded within ourselves as we can be. And, you know, I get these questions all the time, as I'm sure you do. What's going to happen? When's it going to happen? Do you have a timeline? Blah, blah, blah. And what that comes down to, I think, a lot of the time is, how can I control the situation? Boy, if I just know what's going to happen, I'll be safe. And the truth is, there's no safe place to be. There's no safe place to go. There's no way to control this. The only thing you really can control is what's going on inside of you. You can certainly work to make things better in your community and your neighborhood, but ultimately you can't control these things. And there's a lot of things now that really have a life of their own, and I know we probably have different opinions about climate change. You've had my friend Guy McPherson on here. That puppy has a life of its own now, and to try to control that or to say, well, you know, if we just cut down the carbon or we just have nuclear power or we just have geoengineering, no, you know, some of these things have a life of their own and we're going to have to come to terms with that.
This is true. And my concern is that people are so much either, you know, This term of living in the past, I saw an interesting Facebook post. I'd like to get your perspective on it, because it's funny I should be interviewing you now, because I didn't know precisely what your field of expertise was. A man was born. He got a good job. He was able to purchase a house, purchase a car, and raise 5 children and go on holidays. That was a long time ago. Today, a man with the same job, being paid the same amount of money, has that man's family living in his basement.
And
this is what occurs to me is that's the steady decline of civilization brought about in no small part by the bankers and what have mm-hmm. you. But mm-hmm. my thought on this was that you can't actually get that back, at least not instantaneously. You can't go back to that pre-collapse scenario where everybody was living high on the hog, can we?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, you said it's a long time ago, but really, I've been around quite a while, and I remember that it wasn't that long ago. I mean, we're talking 30, 35 years ago. You could get that good job, and you could have that good house, and have those vacations, and good benefits, and blah, blah, blah. And today, yes, you know, the same person is living in a basement. He or she is probably unemployed and not being able to get benefits in the United States. And no decent health care coverage and blah, blah, blah. And we are not going to get that back. As a matter of fact, everything is downsizing, and we're going to have to live with that.
Mm. What do you see as being the normal thing? Are we going to have to be in these Agenda 21 slave blocks and do all of that? What kind of freedom is there possible for the human race amid such economic decline?
Well, you know, I don't believe, well, first of all, I do believe that we are heading for more and more tyranny in terms of our governments. Chris Hedges published a wonderful article today that we're in the last gaps of democracy in the United States. Mm. There's no question about that. Now, whether or not these guys are going to have the money and the resources to, you know, be going around and rounding everybody up and maintaining slave camps, you know, I don't know about that. But what I do believe is that we can start building community right now in our neighborhoods, in our villages, in our just areas of where we live. We can start getting to know our neighbors well, sharing food, sharing resources, bartering, and cooperating together so that we can live in a different way, very downsized, but be able to really help each other. And I see that as the most viable and certainly nurturing and supporting way to deal with this.
You're not talking about building community. You're talking about rebuilding community the way a city is rebuilt after carpet bombing.
Yes, and I'm talking about going back and learning a lot of the skills that our grandparents knew and living much the way people had to live in the Great Depression with lots of sharing, lots of bartering, lots of cooperation. Mm. And that's going to look different in every community because it's a unique situation.
Well, I think that, as another Chinese saying is, the character for crisis is the same character for opportunity. And
yes.
I am a great believer of the infinite power of human creativity and our ability to solve problems that seem so massive and so uncontrollable, yet we have a number of geniuses in this world that just pop up at certain points throughout history and just go, actually, no, that's a real simple solution. Here it is.
Well, you know, I believe that we have genius in each one of us has genius. In West Africa, they have a word called genie, which doesn't mean like the genie in the bottle. It literally means genius. And their belief is that every child is born with genius and that the reason we're here is to bring that out and to use it to serve the community. And so I think that when we are under great stress and pressure, that genius will come out. But why not prepare for that now? Why not nurture that and bring it out now before we're under pressure?
Mm-hmm. And in so doing, I think getting rid of public education to a large degree, or at the very least changing the curriculum to the 9th degree, would be a good start.
Yes, and I am so in favor of people who are homeschooling, who are creating alternative kinds of schools, because, you know, certainly here in the United States, it's nothing more than the prison-to-pipeline situation. Guy McPherson calls it the K through 12 incarceration system that just has dumbed everybody and everything down, and that needs to really change.
Well, I've said for a long time that prison is merely a postgraduate course of high school.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Now, if you've got that situation, and this is kind of one of my little pet hates, is people telling you what to do, telling you how to think, and what have you. I had to put up with that for quite a number of years before I realized these people who are telling me what to do are actually dumber than I am.
That's right.
You know, what was it? Picasso, I think he said, all children are born artists. The trick is to remain an artist as you grow up.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the genius.
Yeah. Now, creativity, I think Sir Ken Robertson, who did a TED Talk, and he defined creativity as original ideas that have value. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. Let's say, for instance, building community, as you've suggested, is not an original idea by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
However, because we're in a new situation now where community doesn't actually exist anymore, community has actually been very strong all the way through history, until such a point as, say, the Federal Reserve System had been instituted mm-hmm. for a while. We had a couple of world wars. And with public education being instituted and mass media and so on and so forth, the people around you seem to fade into the background. And mm-hmm. the things that are in front of you, the things that are compelling your attention, are all controlled by either the government or massive corporations that own the government. Mm-hmm. You know? All right. So it's kind of like we've been living in this sort of Lego land sort of thing, you know. It can all be bashed over really, really easily if you just realize you're living in a Lego playland. The difficulty is whether or not you're prepared to see the roof collapse in on you in order to make yourself free.
That's exactly right. And, you know, as we continue to look at these things, back to the question that you asked me about, you know, those moments of truth and how I said I had to keep going with each one and make a decision at each point. I talk to many, many people because I do a lot of life coaching. And I talk to many, many people who have woken up to collapse. And they say the same thing, that, you know, you have to be prepared to, as you look at this, you have to be prepared to lose everything.
Mm.
And you have to understand that life as you have known it is hugely and quickly slipping away, and you don't know where that's going to take you. You have no assurance of what that's going to look like when it's all said and done. You know, if you're going to end up a homeless person in the street, if you're going to end up in a nice, warm, smushy community with people of like mind, you know, you just don't know.
Two things occurred to me while you were saying that is, firstly, is a quote from Fight Club. It's only after you've lost everything that you're free to do anything.
Exactly, yeah.
And the second, I had a conversation with Stuart and Janet Swerdlow a number of years ago, and we talked about this, a survival collapse, and all these people storing food and water and what have you, and they were just laughing. And I was like, why are you laughing? Isn't storing food and water a good idea? And they go, no, not really, because there's two things in a crisis that you're really going to need a hell of a lot more than food and water. Number one, toilet paper.
Yeah.
And number two, the most valued commodity of all, this, your
mm-hmm.
mind.
Mm-hmm.
That is the survival tool that is always there for you. And it's kind of like on that movie The Edge with Sir Anthony Hopkins, and he says people get themselves into bad situations and they keep blaming themselves. Oh, how did I get into this? What did I do to deserve this? And they sit there and they die because they didn't do the one thing that could have saved their lives. Thinking.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, in some situations, like in that movie, you're by yourself. But the one thing that survivalists are excluding to their own demise, I believe, is the need for connecting with other people. Because they think, you know, if I have the gas mask, if I have the bunker, if I have the beans and bullets, I'll be okay. I don't need my neighbors. I don't need anybody else. And there was a wonderful article today in Alternet, which is out of the United States, that, you know, this whole notion of the doomsday prepper who's by themselves, it's kind of a revisiting of the Marlboro Man. You know, I'm going to do it all myself on my own. That seals our fate right there, because we're going to need each other in order to survive, as well as what's up here.
It's absolutely true. I mean, like, even in our own lives, you know, just look at your own life and think about just how desperately you need everybody that's currently in your life.
Absolutely.
I need the people who are running the internet company to keep doing their job so that I can keep doing mine. I need these pieces of technology to keep working. I need my guests to show up. I need them to be able to think and speak. As soon as all of those disappear, I will disappear soon after.
Yes.
And I think this is what is so important to recognize, is the value of other people. You've got to really value yourself, of course, but you don't realize that you are not an island. You are part of a continent.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the developed world, in the Western world, it's all about independence, or, you know, a subtle kind of dependence on various things. But we have not learned, as indigenous people know and have known for thousands of years, that we are interdependent, and to really value that interdependence. And, you know, back to this whole thing about how we got so isolated. You know, I was thinking, as you were talking about the 1950s, when I was a little kid, and suburbia was everything. You know, it's like, get your own little house with all of its appliances, and get your own car, and just really isolate yourself in this little bubble. You don't really need to know your neighbors. You don't really need to get to know the people you work with that well. It's just me and my family, and that's it. And so what has happened with that is then when people do wake up and they want to create community, or they want to be part of a community, they kind of have to learn from the ground up how to do community. Yes, it's in our DNA, but we have so much wounding and so much individualistic programming that when we go into community living or just interacting in a community, we kind of have to learn new communication skills and how to do that all over again. Mm-hmm. And I talked to so many people who have tried to go into an intentional community. They couldn't hang with it because so many other people were, there was so much conflict, and people were not able to communicate clearly, and so it fell apart. Mm. And I unfortunately see this all the time, and I think this is a huge piece of work that we have to do in order to cooperate with each other.
Do you believe that community is for a person not entirely dissimilar from, say, nutrition, right? It's kind of like vitamin C deficiency. You get scurvy. We're suffering. Yep. We're suffering from community scurvy.
We are. Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree.
We're bleeding from the gums here.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
I actually feel it's quite tragic, because despite the fact that I know that this is going on, I still have yet to go to talk to my neighbours and so on and so forth. I mean, there's a couple of people who live near me. The people at the front are really mean and terrible, and so we're getting the frack out of here pretty soon. But, but you know, the very next door neighbours are nice, but in terms of like down the street and all of that kind of thing, one of my activist friends, Penelope Bryant, right here in New Zealand, used to talk about what they called borough councils back in the day, before cities used to amalgamate little small sections and suburbs and communities into greater councils with more and more concentrated control and monetary resources them piled on at the top so that it's basically much easier for corrupt people to run the place, more or less. What she told me about these borough councils is that they actually did a really, really good job, incredibly efficiently. How did they do all of this? How did they have really good information about their communities, and how were they Johnny on the spot whenever there was a tree down or a power line or a pothole or anything like that? They were fixed very, very quickly indeed. It was because they employed one person per street to report back to the council of any problems. It was their job to communicate with all of the people within those streets that was their responsibility, to find out what all of their concerns were and report back to the council. And not only did they get exempted from their rates and not have to pay and could live much cheaper as a result of doing that community service, but the community itself benefited massively from the efficiency that it actually wrought, and indeed generated a surplus in funding for the councils, and they even gave the citizens rebates. Now today it is the direct opposite. You want something done? You got a centralized command. Take ages to get out here. Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling us. Now I've got to call about 7 different private contractors and then pay them all a consultancy fee before they send a truck out to just remove that one branch off of your road.
Right. Exactly.
See, that is the epitome of community versus what would you say? What's the opposite of community? Is there a word for it?
Well, individualism and a sense of independence, super independence, and of course that leads to isolation. And I think that the only thing, and I could be wrong, but the only thing that is going to compel us to live successfully in community is when our life depends on it. Right now, a lot of people have the luxury of, oh, I think I'll go into an intentional community or not. I think I'll get involved with my neighbors or not. And when our lives depend on it, whether or not we eat depends on it, then I think we'll find ways to get along.
I think you're right. And that's a good place to leave the first segment. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Carolyn Baker. You're not a doctor by chance?
I have a PhD, yes.
Ah, so it's Dr. Carolyn Baker. Can I ask, what age were you when you actually obtained that qualification?
Let's see, I was in my 40s. I was in my mid-40s, I believe, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had you been aware of the collapse and all of these things while you were in that higher education system?
No, not at that time. It wasn't, that was... actually got the PhD in the mid-80s, so I didn't really wake up to what was going on in terms of collapse until 2004 or 5, something like that. Yeah.
Now, I feel that there's a transition period that happens between going in from higher education to actually knowing what's going on, and I think the two are mutually exclusive. And there was a great post on Facebook. It says, what was it? Education to reward those who can follow orders and repeat accurately what they are told to repeat, and making them think that this makes them smarter than everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, that's the complete loss of what the word education means. It's a Latin word that means educare, means to lead out. And so a true educator, tries to see what is within that person that is their genius and then helps to bring that out of them, really nurtures whatever that is and supports them in bringing that out. And of course, our public school systems are nowhere close to that.
Well, public schools were originally established to meet the needs of industrialism. They turn a organic being into a machine, more or less. That appears to be what it was meant for. And indeed, the reason why this became so prominent is not only because it's so much easier to create obedient, unthinking, uncreative people that are much easier to control for those people already in power, but it also gives the government an ability to indoctrinate all of those people, perhaps with a false sense of patriotism, so that if the country goes into a war, they have many, many willing people, young, bright, flowering, who are willing to be exterminated.
Absolutely. I mean, it's teaching this false sense of loyalty and patriotism. And that's one piece of it. And another piece of it is that people come out of these institutions now, and even if they're, getting bachelor's degrees, they're coming out with no skills. And today I was reflecting, in the state of Minnesota today, there's a wind chill of below 40 below, 60 below, something like that. And schools are closed because of the cold, not because of snow, but because of the cold. And I was just thinking about, there are some little schools in the state of Vermont, and I lived in the state of Vermont for a year, some little schools, private schools, that are put together by the community where the children do everything outside. It's cold? Oh, you build a fire. You build a shelter. You learn how these survival skills of being outside, and then you have all your lessons outside, and you take little walks, and you do things, and all of the teaching takes place outside. And I was wondering today, gee, I bet it's about as cold in Vermont as it is in Minnesota, and I wonder if those kids are outside learning how to survive in the cold, And it's sad when I certainly understand why you wouldn't want to send your kid to school in 40 below wind chill, but I also think there's an opportunity there that those kids could learn how to survive in that environment, even as cold as it is. There's a missed opportunity there, in my opinion.
I believe so. It's what we call bubble wrap children.
Yes, yes.
Now, I don't know about you, but when I fell off the swing as a boy, I scraped my knee. And I learned to not fall off the swing.
That's right.
Now, they've got this padding, literally padding on every playground. Yeah, it's like almost impossible to hurt yourself. Mm-hmm. Look, kids break their arms, kids break their legs, they heal, they learn, they grow up. Okay, and I think this is what is part of the agenda, is to prevent children from actually growing up. And I think trauma, pain, suffering, and healing, and getting over things, and actually having those trials and tribulations, are those things that actually make balanced adults who are capable of taking challenges as they come at them, and then are capable of passing those lessons on to their children. That's been eliminated almost.
Yeah. And, on a playground that's not padded, so a kid falls down and he skins his knee and he goes in and somebody, in a good situation, somebody is there to bandage and to say, I'm sorry that happened and you have to be more careful next time. And there's some human interaction there. And you don't prevent that from happening. You allow that to happen because that's an important human interaction. Mm-hmm. But, in the world today, it's like the parents want to prevent their children from any suffering. And I know so many public school teachers here in the United States, and I'm assuming it's that way in all of the developed countries, that parents do not want their children to suffer in any way, shape, or form. They don't want them to have 1 second of a negative feeling. They also instill in children that they are entitled. They are entitled not to have to suffer, especially if they're white and middle class. You don't have to suffer. That's needless. And anybody who makes you suffer or, you know, makes you complete an assignment or gives you any stress, I mean, come to me and tell me and we'll take them out, you know, because, hey, you shouldn't have to do that. That's a lot of what is communicated to our children today. And that keeps them from growing up. That prevents resilience from developing, and really infantilizes an entire culture.
Helplessness.
Yeah.
Learn helplessness. Yeah.
We said in stereo.
You know, you've got to love it. And I think it's kind of like a smorgasbord to a degree. And you have a look at the food pyramid. This is changing a little bit here. But you have a look at the food pyramid as it currently stands in the United States. You know, you got your meat, your sweets, and your food, and a little bit of fruit and veggies and what have you. And a farmer was once shown this food pyramid by a nutritionist. And he said, "That's the exact same diet I put my cows on before I fatten them up for the slaughter."
Exactly.
Yeah. And so, you know, it occurs to me that we're literally being farmed.
Yes.
So, yeah. How does a farmed animal who has been domesticated their entire life even recognize the fact that they're a farmed animal? Even concoct a scheme to free themselves from the farmer's potential slaughter?
Well, I think, in terms of human beings, it is necessary to have some very deep suffering. And so some people, not a lot of people, but some people are waking up because they've lost a job and they're not going to get it back, and they're not going to get any job back, and they're in their 50s, or maybe they're totally screwed on their retirement, or they've developed a very serious illness, or they've had a home foreclosure and a bankruptcy, those kinds of things. And then they begin to question the system and go, not what it was cracked up to be. Mm. And they begin to look deeper. But most people resist looking deeper until they're really forced to, I think.
Mm. Now, false flag terrorism, let's say take 9/11 for example, a self-inflicted wound in order to make the country think that there's a pain, a threat, something to respond to, something to look deeper into. Oh, let's go after terrorism. Mm-hmm. Now, I thought, what if people who recognize, and I'm talking about good people, who recognize what false flag terrorism is? I would never do this myself, and it's just morally unconscionable. However, what if a whole bunch of people dressed up as police officers and just started beating the hell out of ordinary innocent citizens? Now, I've been arrested by police, and that was a huge wake-up call for me, and it made me start to question everything. Like, hold on a second, these people are liars. Hold on a second, these laws are unjust. Hold on a second, they're making up evidence. Hold on a second, this system is really, really expensive. Somebody's getting rich, somebody's full of crap, and somebody's suffering. And I'm getting the short end of the stick. Have you any compulsion to do that on purpose to people? And I don't think that any good, decent person would deliberately inflict suffering on others. Ergo, and this is an important realization for me, good people need evil people to attack them and attempt to destroy them so that they can actually become good people. Really good people who are active and powerful and strong and resistant.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can't get anywhere in the world. We can't evolve and we can't fulfill our potential or be who we came here to be without confronting evil, you know. And maybe we confront it directly, but usually it confronts us. It comes after us. And, you know, and through injustice, through sexual abuse, through whatever. And then we have to deal with that. And we have to look at what life really is. And that life is not all, you know, sweetness and light and unicorns and kangaroos with rainbows. You know, life is, it's a real mixed bag. And we have to be able to look at that darkness. And that's one of the things that I write about a lot and speak about a lot is, you know, I'm a big fan of Carl Jung, and I look at and talk about the importance of dealing with the darkness. Mm-hmm. Because we're in such a bright-sided culture. You know, everything has to be positive, the yellow smiley faces, yeah. And, you know, that's part of our growing up. That's part of our maturity.
Mm. Is it absolutely necessary? And I think I asked the late Bob Chapman about this. I asked him, is there any way to permanently disable the ability of tyrannical scum from getting in power? Corruption, in other words. He says, absolutely not. It's a perennial problem. All right, it is perpetual.
Mm-hmm.
Now, knowing that you have a war that will continue forever. It is more or less about winning battles, not winning the war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we do that one by one, I think.
Now, are you talking about a literal war, or are you talking about a psychological war? What are you talking about?
It's actually a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B, because I believe that there is a real war being waged by the evil scumbaggery agents of the New World Order upon humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
at the same time, we are at conflict within ourselves, for we've been under the influence of these education systems, mass media and government for so long that in a lot of ways, the people are their own worst enemy.
Yeah, I mean, we really have to do battle with evil. And I go back to the Buddhist tradition of the Shambhala warrior who sees that evil and is not intending to harm anyone, but really sees it for what it is and develops the kind of stealth and the kind of wisdom to wage war in a way that doesn't necessarily win in terms of what the culture thinks of winning, but perhaps takes him and himself and his community to a higher level.
In other words, he recognizes that fighting fire with fire just gets both people burned.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of those important things that I believe should be repeated over and over again. You know, I was just thinking this morning, you know, it would be great if all of us in the alternative media and the actual thinkers who actually give a frack about other people, you know, that kind of thing, who've gone through a whole lot of crap, and so that we can see how asleep everybody else is and really appreciate how awake we truly are. This is the moment, I think, in time where, for the first time in history, we actually have the knowledge and the technology to expose what evil truly is, not from just a spiritual or religious perspective, but from real evidentiary balanced truth, from a scientific perspective. And there's a flip side to that as well, a scientific dictatorship. That's what we're dealing with, is people who have so much knowledge about our psychology, what makes us tick, and can use that knowledge to manipulate us and bend us to their will. And I think it's, how do you know if you're brainwashed? If you never question whether or not you're brainwashed.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I want to just mention, because I haven't, my website is carolynbaker.net, and I publish 7 days a week a daily news digest called Speaking Truth to Power. And in this digest, I try to gather the best alternative news on economics, environment, civil liberties, geopolitical issues, culture. And at the bottom, I have a section called Real Options, in which I publish different ways that people are dealing with these issues around the world in a positive way. And now everybody says, well, I can go to the, I don't have to subscribe to this. It is based on a subscription model. And, you know, people would say, well, I can find all this stuff on the internet. Yes, you can. And what I do is I do it for you and I send it to your inbox 7 days a week. And I really try to explore and shine the light on as much as possible, put under the microscope exactly what we're talking about here, Vinny, in terms of the evil as well as the good.
I said on my show one time, I would prefer it if nobody listened to my radio show, so long as everybody who did once listen to my radio show started their own mm-hmm. website, wrote a book, mm-hmm. made a mm-hmm. documentary, ran for yeah. Congress, something of that nature. There are people like me all around the world, and it actually pains me that instead of fulfilling their potential, they're sitting here listening to myself.
I agree. I totally agree.
Now, that's what the basis of selflessness actually is. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I've suffered a lot, you know, like a violent father, got arrested by the cops twice, and I lost all my friends. I had tens of thousands worth of stuff stolen from me by my flatmates while I was away for a long weekend, and you know, just endless jobs, just where I was working for a psychopath who was manipulating me and just taking everything and using my productivity in order to keep his wheels spinning while grinding my soul to a halt. I know what it is like, and I don't like seeing other people go through it. Unfortunately, though, they have to go through it so that
they
too can see what it is like.
And so that they, not only so they can, you know, see what it's like, but so they can really access that genius within themselves. And then, you know, when you find your gifts, then it's time to give them. And so, you know, everybody that I work with who's awakened to collapse, so many people come to me and they say, I'm awake, I see what's going on, and how can I serve now? Would you help me find these gifts, and what's the best way to use them? What's the best way to put them out there? And that is so exciting. And what I find without exception is that when people begin to wake up to this and begin to wake up to their gifts, they say to me, man, I thought I was alive before this, and now I feel 100 times more alive than I've ever been. And I know all this terrible stuff, but now I feel more alive.
Mm-mm. Somebody asked me once, you know, Vinny, I want to do what you do. What do I do first? And I said, well, here's your first mistake. You started off by asking somebody else for help.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, really. I mean, it's just like, no, I don't need any help. I don't need anybody's input. I don't need anything. All I want is what is up here and what these hands can do. And I will make it freaking happen by myself. Once you realize that, once you realize you don't actually need somebody to be looking over your shoulder, you don't need somebody to be waking you up in the morning and making you coffee and telling you to go to work at certain times, once you realize that you can actually take personal responsibility, not only for your own actions, but you can also take personal responsibility for the things that are happening around you, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, take myself as an example. I noticed that there was no alternative media in New Zealand, okay? People always say, oh, you're talking about the problems, tell us the solutions. Well, there was no alternative media in New Zealand, so I solved that problem, you know? And you know what's ironic is that people still criticize me for doing this work and everything like that and not proposing enough solutions during the broadcast. I'm solving a problem right here. I can't solve the world's problems. I can't solve everything.
Right.
But I have found my talent. I have found my skill. I have found where I can actually be of use to others, and that empowers me. That gives me strength.
Absolutely.
And in so doing, I can actually help myself and help others without actually asking for it.
Well, you know, back to the issue of community, because You know, on the one hand, we don't need anybody to tell us, oh, this is your genius. Have you thought about being an alternative media person? But when we discover that, oh, I think I might be able to do that, it's good to have support.
Yeah.
It's good to have somebody say, I really see that for you. I'm behind you 100%. So that's where the community piece comes in, because you discovered that potential on your own. And then when somebody comes in and says, Vinny, you know, I see it too, man, do it. Then that's when real community happens.
You're completely correct. And what's interesting is that as soon as you don't need any help and you do it on your own, that's when help starts coming.
That's right.
Before you start doing anything, you think that you need so much help, and you go to people, you say, can you help me with this? Can you do that? And whatever. And they're like, you're not doing anything, bro. I'm not going to help you.
Right.
I love the irony of life itself. Almost everything in life is ironic to me.
Yeah, that's the paradox, and you know, that's a lot of what Lao Tzu talked about as well. That's the Eastern perspective of both and. Yeah.
Now, in terms of waking up, and I love it how people use this term waking up, because it's actually a really good analogy. It means you've been asleep, you're not actually looking because your eyes are closed and your mind is off. What do you do after you wake up in the morning? You get out of bed, don't you?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
People are obsessed with waking up, and they don't follow it through to its logical conclusion about getting out of bed, getting yourself prepared for the day. Have a coffee and breakfast or whatever, but you've got to go to work. And I think I was out attending a protest, and a guy came up to me and he says, "Why don't you get a job?"
Oh, hey. I got the best job on the planet, dude.
Okay. It's like, dude, how many hours a week do you work? Oh, I work 40. Okay, I work 65, give or take. Sometimes more, maybe sometimes if I'm lucky, a little less. So I work harder than you do. So can I ask you, why don't you go get another job? Okay. Now, here's a question. Why should I stop doing my work just so that I can satisfy you not doing anything of value in your life? Mm-hmm. You know, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to get a slave job like you? Am I supposed to go live in a slave block with my slave wife and my slave kids with my slave car and my slave money? You know, no. Why should I do that? You can't come up with any logical reasons, can you? You know why? It's because you don't even know that you're a slave.
That's right. That's right.
That's the awakening process within it. And it's kind of like Mark Passio, I think, from whatonearthishappening.com, amazing researcher, former priest of the Church of Satan, of all things.
Mm.
And what he said, I think, was really, really interesting. He defined slavery thus. You would agree that if you worked and you made money and 100% of all of that money went to somebody else, that you'd be a slave. You'd agree with that, right?
Right.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
What about if it's 30%?
Mm-hmm.
What if it's 40? What if it's 50? The fact of the matter is you don't have a choice in how much tax you have to pay and all of that kind of stuff, and that in and of itself is slavery.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
People get offended, you know. It's just like, you're calling me a slave, you're calling me a slave. Mm-hmm. Dude, if you're white and I call you white, do you get offended? If you're tall and I call you tall, do you get offended? Reality does not change via your perspective. You can perceive it differently, but unfortunately a fact is a fact regardless of how you perceive it in most cases. And people have forgotten this, that there is such a thing as objective truth. Now, it may be painful to recognize that you're not actually free. It may be terrifying to recognize that there really is a criminal cabal of elite scumbaggery individuals who control the world and, in many ways, a lot of your life. That may be terrifying. It may be sad. It may be harsh. It may even be traumatic, like losing a loved one and you go through all these stages of grief. That is precisely what happens. However, it is the reality. And unfortunately, as Ayn Rand said, you can ignore reality, but you cannot ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Yeah. So we have to look at our limits, you know, and choose, you know, what, I guess, choose our battles and choose, you know, okay, so if I live in the United States, I have to pay taxes. I mean, you do in every country, but I have to pay a certain amount of taxes. What is the cost if I choose not to pay the taxes? And would I rather pay some taxes and still be able to do my work? Or would I choose not to pay my taxes and be in jail where I can't do my work? Blah, blah, blah. Those kinds of things.
Mm. See, what I choose to do is pay my taxes so I can do my work so that I can interview the people who don't pay their taxes and teach other people how to not do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
See, again, it's kind of like, I almost, as I mentioned before, almost everything in life is an irony, that kind of Eastern philosophy, as you pointed out. And in such a way, what you can do is you can model your life where almost everything that you do is in some way a contradiction. In so doing, you can never be boxed in. You can never actually stop learning, right. Because that's one of the amusing things that I find about people. They come out of high school or they come out of higher education, thinking that they know everything and they don't have to learn anything anymore, okay? Like, oh, the learning part of my life is over. Okay, sweet ass. It's just like, you're still alive, bro. While you're still alive, if you ain't learning, your brain starts to atrophy. You lose the ability to learn, all right? And it's very, very true. All the people in our community, we've kind of... You've noticed this, haven't you? A global community is now actually forming.
Mm-hmm.
For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, right? So, mm-hmm. you know, you've got a global government forming with scumbags, but you've mm-hmm. also got a global resistance that's forming.
Absolutely.
In order to counteract it and go against it. So there's always hope there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know about hope. That's not my favorite word, but. But there's certainly a balance, an increasing balance of energy, a changing of the balance of energy, so that these guys are not totally without resistance and totally, you know, without any kind of barrier in the way. There is, and who knows how long that's going to last, that you and I can do what we're doing. I mean, I'm grateful each day when I get up that I can do what I do. I am extremely grateful. I wouldn't be doing anything else. You know, I love the work that I do, and I know you do too. And it's like, I'm just so grateful that I can do it, and I hope that it lasts a long time. I hope this freedom that we have to do this lasts a long time.
Yeah, yeah, and what's interesting is that the longer that we do this, it emboldens us. I mean, do you feel like it's slightly more confident each day?
Oh yes.
You know, like what was it? Somebody was like attacking me or accusing me of being lazy or a bum or something of that nature. I think this might have been a year ago or so. And if you look back through my history just over the last 4, 5, 6 years or so that I've been an activist, filmmaker, radio show host, yada, 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 you can see that I have accomplished extraordinary things. Many people would never even dream of doing what I have done.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to this person, I'm Vinny frickin' Eastwood, mate. you know what I'm saying? I am who I am, and there is nothing you can do to stop me.
Yes, good for you.
All right, and that's something I believe, that personal power, that confidence. I mean, dare I say it, I might be a little bit arrogant, perhaps a touch narcissistic. However, my intentions and my actions are the fruits by which I can be defined at, and regardless of my faults, my fruits still pluck off that tree.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, you know, I like to just point out that there's a force, there's something greater within all of us. Again, I think it's connected with that genius that is even greater than the mind and the ego, that, you know, kind of has a life of its own. And if we tap into it, it empowers us even more.
That's true. And support, as you mentioned before, is also a very important part of that. I think, are you married?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
No. But I have a wonderful support system in my life. And, you know, if I didn't, I don't know what I would do. But it's really important for us in this kind of work, you know, because we are warriors in a different way. And we need, as we go into this battle, we need all the support we can get.
That's true. And I was talking to my friend Mike yesterday. He's a guitarist. He's an amazing photographer, but he hasn't been doing a whole lot of gigs with his guitar. He hasn't been doing a whole lot of photography. He just mostly does his gardening work, right? And we were talking yesterday about how he's actually kind of sick of absorbing more information every day. You know, he goes to the internet mm-hmm. cafe, he listens to my show, mm-hmm. he listens to Alex Jones, and, mm-hmm. and what have you. And he was starting to realize that he's actually sick of just absorbing other people's information. He's sick of watching what other activists are doing, and he wants to start doing it himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important part. Now, just knowing that there is something that you want to work towards that's different from what you're doing right now, that's different from what you've been doing your entire life. And I said to him, you know, dude, you know, you've always been there for me. You've always been mm-hmm. helping me. I help lots of people. So if you're helping me, you're already participating in activism. However, mm-hmm. I would much prefer you to actually start, you know, as you want to do, start doing your own activism. And I can support you in any way that you wish, just to basically pay back all of these, all of the comforts you have given me, all of the support you've given me. Now, pray tell, you said you have a support network. Would you mind telling me what it actually is? How it works?
Well, it's friends, you know, various friends who I consider also awake. And I started a little group here in Boulder, Colorado about 4 years ago called Growing Resilience. And we meet once a month and we have incredible discussions. Sometimes we study a book. Sometimes we do social things. But we talk a lot about how we feel about all of this and how we're developing and how we're growing and sometimes how we're suffering with just being awake. And so that has been extremely helpful. And I get a tremendous amount out of working with coaching clients and seeing their growth. And I'm just very grateful that I, you know, I don't feel alone with all of this. I feel very supported.
Somebody comes up to you and they say, hey bro, you're a slave, and these people that are enslaving you are eventually going to exterminate you, and society's going to collapse, and all your comforts are going to disappear. Everything that you hold dear will be annihilated forever, and the world will live in perpetual darkness. And you're like, well, that's not good. So, that doesn't make me feel good at all. You know, how on earth do I deal with this? It's much like depression. And I had a great quote. I think quite a few years ago. I forget who said it, but depression is anger minus the motivation.
Mm.
Right,
mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I would much rather get angry at the system that enslaves me, then get depressed about the fact that it's enslaving me. Because at least when I'm angry, I fight against it. I do something mm-hmm. about it. When I'm depressed, I withdraw. I don't talk to people who could possibly support me or encourage me or enlighten me in, as to the fact. You know what I'm saying?
Well, there's another emotion, too. And, you know, in my book, Navigating the Coming Chaos, I talked about the big five emotions that I think are involved with this collapse. Fear, anger, grief, despair, and surprisingly, joy. And depression is not one of those. Depression, I think, is suppressed grief. And while I am all in favor of anger and getting impassioned about resistance, I think it's very important, and I'm finding this increasingly as I deal with people, for us to really look at our grief, to look at the losses and how we feel about what's been stolen from us, what's been taken away from us, the way our souls have been murdered, the way the earth is being murdered. I think it's extremely important to deal with that grief. And many indigenous cultures know this. They know the power of feeling our grief. My friend Jack Adam Weber calls it the power of heartbreak. And when we can allow ourselves to feel that and let those tears wash us, it doesn't take us down, down, down. What it does is it makes us more alive. It makes us more grateful. It impassions us. It just kind of washes everything clean. And so I am a huge fan of dealing with grief. And I teach people how to do this. I do workshops on it. And I think it's a very important piece in our waking up and staying awake.
What do you tell people about how to deal with grief?
Well, I give them some tools like, just go take a walk in nature. Go take a walk in nature and, look around you and see what you see, because wherever you go, you're going to see some loss. You're going to see some trees that are dying. You're going to be aware of some animals that are going extinct. You're going to see the landscape has changed maybe since you were a little kid. And, you're going to notice that that stream is a little dirtier than it was before. And let nature talk to you. And you can do some journaling. You can talk to other people. You can just let yourself feel the loss. As you read the news, I mean, if you read the news every day and you don't feel some grief, then I want to check your vital signs, because I'm not sure you're alive. And let ourselves feel about that. And yes, of course, it can become overwhelming. And we don't want to, move into it and redecorate and stay there. But to let ourselves have these moments of grief. And then we balance it with going and talking with friends and having a good time and experiencing some joy in our lives. But the grief has got to be in the mix if we're going to really be awake and stay that way.
Mm. Now, I want to ask something really important. Can you tell me what was your grief that you had to deal with, and how did you overcome it?
Well, it's not like it was. It's kind of ongoing. There was certainly grief of childhood and childhood wounding. And then as I deepened in my awareness of what was going on in the world, then certainly I was in the education field at the time that I was waking up. And, the grief of seeing what has been done to children, what has been done to people, as we were talking about earlier, that doesn't allow them to grow up, that doesn't allow them to think critically. And then I got more aware of, well, certainly the wars. Oh, my God, the wars. And I was just thinking today about, 10 years ago, we were all 2004. We were talking about the Battle of Fallujah. Well, guess what? Today in 2014, we're talking about Fallujah again. It's erupted again for lots of different reasons that have to do with U.S. occupation. And, the U.S. may be back there in Iraq because, hell, we got to keep that oil, right? And then the grief that I began to really feel deeply, and I'm still feeling it every day, about nature and what's being done to this planet and the extinction of species and, of course, the extinction of our own species. So that grief is ongoing, and I don't expect it to go away. And you know what? I don't really want it to go totally away, because I want to remain sensitive. I want to remain really impassioned about why all of this is so important.
Can I ask what makes people close off from that? Is it a fear of suffering?
Yeah. It's too scary, for one thing. And for another thing, we are so inculcated in this culture that grief is not okay. And I think that's the reason for the massive depression in the developed world. Depression is grief unexpressed. And it's depressed. And so, people are told, for example, here in the United States, you lost a loved one, so you can have some time off. We'll give you bereavement leave, and you can be gone for a few days. But when you come back, we don't want to see any signs of your grief. No tears. You had your bereavement leave. Put it behind you. It's over and done. That's it. Over. And, you know, you start talking about grief very much, you know, like say you lost somebody six months ago and you talk about it now. Well, I thought you grieved. I mean, that was 6 months ago. What's wrong with you? Maybe you need some medication, you know, maybe you're mentally ill. And so we just don't have much tolerance in this culture for grief because it's weak. It's not macho. It's not, you know, we're not in control, blah, 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 all of that.
Well, they want to drug us all up. And this is another thing. What's the most profitable industry in the world? It's the drug companies, isn't it?
Right.
You know, other than private central banking. But
and let's not forget the weapons industry.
Of course. Well, I think they all kind of own each other. It's kind of like, you know how anacondas reproduce? They have what's called a mating ball. We have all of these snakes writhing together and stuff like that. There's only one female snake in the middle and all the males are trying to get in on it, that kind of thing. That's what it's like. Basically, we're in the middle of a corporate anaconda mating ball and it can swallow you whole and it would quite likely just vomit you up so that it can kill and eat again at its leisure and pleasure. And, you know, I've got this idea that every single time that we look at this thing, it damages us a little, right? And I think that every single time you get damaged a little, if you don't allow time to rebuild, you wind up living worse off the very next day. You know, it's kind of like if you have your country bombed and you don't rebuild your cities, your country doesn't recover, does it? And depression is the exact same thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I must, you know, even though I put out the news every day, it doesn't stop me from crying sometimes about what I'm reading and just stopping and just having to take a really deep breath. It's like, oh, my God, you know. Mm. And I take care of myself. I take really good care of myself. I meditate a couple of times a day. I get down on the floor and play with my dog. You know, I take walks, call up a friend. I think I go to the gym. I take really good care of myself. But if it doesn't get to you in some way, then again, I want to check your vital signs, and you really need to take care of yourself. And I'm sure you have a support system. We all need a support system in doing this work.
Oh, I have umpteen enormous different support systems.
Like, great.
And, it's amazing. Like, I'll type one depressing thing on Facebook, and before I know it, I've got like 12 Skype messages from good mates. I've got friends calling me or whatever, you know. It's kind of like I call out for help, and I think I only call out for help when I actually feel that I need it, right? When I'm not just kind of like, you know, I can't maintain this by myself. This is actually a little harsh. Is there anybody else who can give me some philosophy, some encouragement, or anything like that? Uh-huh. And when you get insulted or your character is assassinated or something, it's actually kind of some of the worst annoyance and just that you can really imagine. And I think my friend Catherine Smith, who's the editor of the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine, she gave me this piece of wisdom. You know, it occurs to me that almost all of my friends are nearly double my age, right? And a friend of mine yesterday said, "Vinny, you're so wise." And I said, "No, I'm not actually that wise. All I've got is accumulated wisdom from people who are far wiser than I." Mm-hmm. And that's wisdom that I haven't really earned by myself. But what she told me was, don't take yourself too seriously. And don't take what other people say about you personally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Right. And understand, you know, we have, we all have a human ego. And then back to this other part that I was talking about earlier, the greater self, I choose to call it sometimes the sacred, you know, the genius within us, the spiritual part of us that is greater than all of that and is beyond all of that. And we can learn from these hurts about the tempering of the ego, because really I believe bottom line, why we are here on this planet is to shrink, to allow the ego to shrink, and to the and then to allow the sacred and the greater self to expand. And sometimes these onslaughts of the ego, you know, it's like, well, okay, so my ego got bruised today. Yeah, okay, and that's not all of who I am.
Yeah. Is there a necessity for the ego? Because I've seen...
Oh, yeah.
That's what I thought, because I see New Age philosophy as like the antithesis of everything real and human, you know? Oh, there's no such thing as suffering. I actually talked to this one guy who says there's no such thing as suffering, there's no such thing as reality, there's no such thing as good, there's no such thing as evil. And I said, okay, what about the 400,000 children that are kidnapped in the United States every year that are never seen again? Quite possibly raped, tortured, and murdered. He goes, oh, they just go to a place of bliss, so it doesn't matter. Well, you've got to be freaking kidding me.
Yeah, exactly. No, the ego is a very important part of us. I mean, as we grow and develop as children, we have to develop an ego. My God, how would you learn anything without your ego? And when people say, oh, the ego's a bad thing, I got rid of my ego. And then, you know, my next question is, so how did you get to the bathroom the last time, and who's got the car keys? You know, it's like we've got to have an ego. But in Western culture, the ego is overdeveloped. In indigenous cultures, traditional societies, they had egos, but they learned that the ego has to have its own smaller place beside this sacred greater self. I see that as the root of all of our issues, all of our issues on this planet, is that the ego has become out of control.
Overinflated.
We've lost the sense of the sacred, and now this huge initiation that the planet is in is a learning experience for the tempering of the ego and the bringing forth of the sacred, the transformation of consciousness. And that's not going to be how that plays out, and how that actually comes about is going to be very painful for our species and for the rest of the planet.
Okay, now let's leave that there for the moment, and we'll be back in just a few minutes, ladies and gentlemen, with Dr. Carolyn Baker.
If you place a thing in the center of your life that lacks the power to nourish, it will eventually poison everything that you are and destroy you. As simple a thing as an idea or your perspective on yourself or the world, no one can be the source of your content. It lies within, in the center.
I'll be with Mella while you're thinking that just lies for me. Only with Mellow while you're thinking of just life, so don't let nothing ride you. If the sons of the boys should give way to die, they would immediately go out. One, swallow don't make a sound, but tomorrow has to start somewhere.
Newspapers entertain, lion tamers die in pain. This child, wise beyond words, whose tears flow without sound.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is still Dr. Carolyn Baker from carolynbaker.net. Now, I wanted to know, how do you feel the interview has been going so far? Because for me personally, this has actually been like quite a one of those higher brow discussions where you actually kind of you learn a lot about yourself through listening to other people explain themselves. You know what I'm saying?
I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I think that, you know, sometimes when I am speaking with other people, I learn a whole lot more about myself by listening to them explain themselves. So, and it's this kind of dialogue, and we're part of what we're doing here, Vinny, is creating community. You know, this is part of what community looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I go to lots of protests all the time, and you always go, this is what democracy looks like. Well, hold on. Ironically, they're actually telling the truth, because a protest is exactly what mob rule looks like.
Indeed.
I just found that really classic, is that people don't even know what it is that they're doing. They don't even know what it is that they're saying, and it's really quite it's always refreshing and invigorating to talk to people like you who have a reasonable handle or lid on things and what have you, and have been and seen been through many years and seen many things in such a way that it's wisdom and intelligence that the world is so often deprived of, because the people who are running the media game and what have you, who would ordinarily be the ones interviewing people like yourself, are so dumb that they don't even know of your existence, let alone understand what the hell you're talking about.
Well, you know, I want to respond to that, yeah, because... what you're talking about, and you said the word wisdom, and that's the magic word, I believe, because what we're really looking for, I say, bottom line in this collapse process, is we're deeply searching the deeper self. And I have a favorite poem about this by David White, who's a Welshman, and he does a lot of work in the U.S. And this little poem is called Loaves and Fishes. And I think of this a lot when I'm surfing the internet or I'm doing what I do on the computer. He says, "This is not the age of information. This is not the age of information. Forget the news and the radio and the blurred screen. This is the time of loaves and fishes. People are hungry, and one good word is bread for 1,000. And so the one good word he's talking about is that conversations like we're having right now that take us to the deeper self. John O'Donohue, another fabulous poet from Ireland, said, "This is the art of the soul, to harvest your deeper life from all the seasons of your experience." And for me, that's what it's all about. Whether it's doing a radio interview or whether it's putting out information in the news, being in a protest, writing an article, it's all about that deeper self. Because let me just kind of explain what I explain in a lot of my workshops. You know, in traditional indigenous societies, when a child is born, it's not just, oh, a child is born. They're aware of the conception of this child and the gestation of this child from the very beginning. And, you know, in some cultures, they actually listen at the mother's belly to try to see what the child is bringing into the world. And so, you know, they know that this child is bringing gifts, the child's bringing genius, and the job of the community is to nurture that. So the child comes in, and he or she is prepared almost immediately for this watershed moment in his or her life around puberty when he or she will be initiated. And the purpose of that initiation is not just to prove some macho ordeal, but to be taken out in nature to have this ordeal so that he or she will have to reach very down deep into the soul to see what they're made of and to really find that sacred self. Then the child is brought back to the community. There's a huge celebration. The elders have been with the kid for the whole time, and they say, "Boy, I see this gift, I see this opportunity, I see this skill that you have. We want to nurture that in you." And so that is all nurtured by the community, and that person becomes more mature. They grow into an adult and then eventually become an elder themselves so that they can do that for the younger people. So my point here is that what I believe is that what we are experiencing right now in this collapse is a planetary initiation where humanity is being taken out into this ordeal. And we're having to reach down deep and find out who we are and what the purpose of our existence is. Most people won't do that. Some people will. And in that way, consciousness can be transformed, and there's a possibility that we might create a new species, that we might create a new kind of human being who will never again have the capacity to allow what has been allowed on this planet to happen. That's one perspective.
Well, it's good, and I think... Raising children, like, I really want to be a father. I've wanted to actually have kids since I was about 14. Like, I really wanted to help raise kids, and haven't yet. 29, still working on it. And I've been talking to a lot of my friends who are fathers, and one thing that they all seem to have to deal with is their life is no longer just their own life. Their life is actually almost exclusively there, not to just live, but to protect and foster and help their child grow in this world. And this is the inherent responsibility, you know, where people always talk about the parents not being responsible and so on and so forth. And that is probably the crux of it. This is why the New World Order targets the family massively, because if you can... I think Germany practiced this quite well. In fact, they managed to indoctrinate children to not see their parents as their parents anymore, but they managed to see the Chancellor as the father, and the state itself as their mother. If you can disassociate people from real parental instincts and replace it with something else, you destroy everything that is good and potentially capable within that child. And that's the very agenda, because it's our genius and our creativity and our love and our caring and our ability to suffer and overcome that is the very antithesis of evil.
And if we had some sort of rite of passage rituals for young people, that couldn't happen. You know?
Well, we have? We have a 21st party where you drink a yard glass.
Right, exactly.
That's your rite of passage. Yeah. You know, you turn 21 and you drink large quantities of beer. Yeah, you're an adult.
Oh, yeah. Right. I know.
Yeah,
it's laughable and it's tragic,
but it's awesome to do. And as long as it's done in context, you know, I don't know about you when you were younger, but when I was a little bit younger, I guess I'm still pretty young now. But I like to party, I like to drink, I like to smoke.
Yep.
You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. So long as you're not just doing it to excess for no good reason whatsoever. There's sometimes where you just feel like, you know what? Frack it. I'm going to get really drunk tonight because I'm just effed off at everything, and I'm just going to get really, really pissed. And then you wake up the next morning without a hangover, not feeling depressed at all. Okay? You know, and it's that really strange sensation of knowing that you almost can imbibe in things that should ordinarily hurt you and destroy you or something, but because your intention is different, your intention isn't just to get wasted for the sake of being wasted, you actually have a reason for doing it. That's actually reasonably healthy. Many ancient cultures used to imbibe in certain substances at certain times in their lives and what have you. I mean, I had a friend who was... of a long line of Celtic druids, and indeed his family gave him a magic mushroom trip as a rite of passage, and guided him through it as a sort of like a spiritual thing, you know, that kind of thing. You have in Mexican culture, you have mescaline peyote in Amazonia, and you have ayahuasca and what have you. And it's occurred to me that the ingestion of substances accomplishes one thing, a skewed vision of reality. Now, a skewed vision of reality can either be a good thing or a bad thing. Are you skewing your vision of reality so that when you come back to it, you see it a hell of a lot more clearly and you really see it for what it is? Or are you trying to skew your vision of reality because you don't like it and you're trying to escape from it?
That's a really good question. And I think that those hallucinogenic experiences are very valuable, but I think they're only a step, and that we have to go further in the spiritual journey, in the journey inward to the deeper self, you know, kind of launching perhaps from those experiences, but taking them much further.
Yeah, indeed.
And without the substance.
Mm-mm-mm. And I think my brother told me of a what are they called? Are they called shaman or yogi or a guru? Sorry, in India, and he was allegedly so spiritually enlightened that they gave him a tab of the world's strongest acid, and it did nothing.
You know? That's very believable. I've heard that story before.
And even if it's not true, it's still a good story. Mm-hmm. And it shows that one can achieve levels of spiritual awareness where substances that are made by man are nothing by comparison. You know, they don't compare. To be in direct touch with the divine is the most powerful drug of all. People say that love's the most powerful drug, and I don't think so. I think divinity is. And
well,
we struggle to find out.
Love
divinity
is certainly part of divinity.
Oh yeah.
But being able to access that sacred power within oneself is the greatest drug of all. But it's not a drug.
Yeah. Well, see, and we talked during the break about how we're all addicted to some kind of substance or whatever.
Right.
You know, it's part of our culture, you know. I'm addicted to coffee, and so are you, and we love it. Can't get away from it. Yeah. You know, I tried to give up coffee one time, but the headaches and the lethargic kind of nature and everything is just like, oh, it was just too much, you know. I can... stopping smoking cigarettes, done that a couple of times. It's actually not that difficult, you know. It's not painful,
right.
it's not traumatic or whatever. Taking away coffee, on the other hand, it becomes an essential part of your life. It's almost like your adrenal glands don't work without it. You become so dependent on it. And this is what happens with a lot of people who are on pharmaceutical drugs and what have you, is that come down. I watched a video of myself today protesting outside a Child, Youth and Family Services, our equivalent of the CPS, where I was talking about how they forcibly drug children with made-up mental disorders in order to justify it, and how sometimes those children, or even sometimes adults, will go off of that medication and they have a complete breakdown. Not because the medication was keeping them stable, but because it kept them dependent, and without that substance, their body was simply unable to function any longer. They grow it on you. And this is what's happening to society now. We're becoming dependent on drugs, not because we actually want to have a good time and we want to actually go through a rite of passage or anything like that.
No.
We just want it just to stay normal, ironically enough.
Well, you know, Jung said that there are sacred initiations, like the rite of passage that I spent a lot of time describing, and there are profane initiations. And most of the initiations in our culture are profane ones, in which we don't, the purpose is not to access any kind of spiritual core. The purpose is to escape, or the purpose is to feel good, or you know, feel better about ourselves, or whatever, or because somebody has told us that we need that particular drug in order to function. So we, you know, the world is filled with profane initiations and in a dearth of sacred ones.
Well, I think the world itself is becoming merely a kind of a cosmic profanity in and of itself. No other species is doing that to this planet, only
that's
us.
Right.
You know,
that's right.
And this goes back to where we started off in the beginning, talking about personal responsibility, because I think it's like, here's a good story here. My brother told me this one as well a number of years ago about the origin of the drug ecstasy. You know how they call it E? Apparently the E originally stood for empathy. And it was a drug that was given to violent fathers. They'd go home to their children, pop an E, and they'd never lay a hand on them again. So effective was it that they made it illegal. You know, and, that was actually quite profound for me to hear that, because it occurs to me that we are losing as a human race our empathy for other people. We stop caring about other people. We're becoming self-centered and shallow, I think. You know, so many of us suffer from this terrible shallowness that is so disgusting. It's like black mold on the walls of a home, eating it away and poisoning everybody that walks into it.
Well, again, it's that absence of community, because one of the things community does is it helps us care about other people and realize that we're not the center of the universe. Mm. And when we don't have that, you know, in these narcissistic developing countries, then we lose all empathy. Mm. And, you know, we become the center of the universe. And, you know, you look at, you know, most animals live in community. And you look at some of the stories, you see viral videos on YouTube all the time of animals that, you know, one will die and the other one will just stay there and stay there and stay there for hours and days beside the dead body of that other animal. You know, it's like you don't see that kind of loyalty in the human species that much.
In fact, there are many... There's so many examples of the human species doing these amazing acts of empathy and love and caring and what have you. But what does the news report on? Death, exactly. War, destruction, murder, disease, and here's a fluffy kitten.
That's true.
Now it...
I don't mean to sound as if, you know, as if humans, because we have this great capacity for compassion. And, you know, when we wake up and we really start looking at collapse, we really start looking at the truth of the situation of our planet, we're just going to invariably experience more compassion, I think.
Well, it's kind of like, in a lot of ways, wasted capacity. Like, let's say, for example, the human race is a Hummer. Okay? It's a vehicle with great capacity. It can haul a lot of things and what have you. But people ain't using it for what it's meant for. They just think it's like some kind of a trinket, some kind of a status symbol. And it was this Bernaysian propagandistic sort of advertising revolution that happened in the 20s and 30s that stopped people from, as you so rightly say, participating quite so much in their communities for their sense of happiness and joy and fulfillment, and instead try to insulate themselves and replace their communities and their friends and their family with items that they think will make them happy, and then they become so surprised that they're miserable, even though they have everything that they thought that they wanted.
You bet. Absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you do when you wake up to that? What do you do?
What do you do when you wake up to the emptiness of things? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of people do wake up to the emptiness of things, and they begin looking inside, you know, because that's where you look. That's what the things are about. The things are about taking your attention out there so you don't have to really feel what's in here or look at what's in here. So many people are afraid of what's in here. And they understand the darkness that's in there, but they've never really found the gold that is in there. And so things keep us from making that discovery. And it's really a beautiful experience to watch people, you know, go, well, those things never really made me happy. There's something deeper. There's something more profound, and that's what I prefer these days. It's beautiful to see people come to that place.
It's kind of like country music in a way, you know. Some of the greatest music and profound things comes out of enormous suffering and loss and what have you. There's a great song called Divorce, I think it is. It says, my wife got the gold mine and I got the shaft.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I know that one.
Yep. Yeah, and again, one of the important things that I found is it's actually a survival mechanism, and I don't think you can actually really truly be human without this. Humor.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, in all of my work, I emphasize hugely the importance of humor and creating beauty. You know, creating beauty wherever we go, and we can do it in simple ways. We don't have to all be Picassos. We don't have to be Beethovens. But we can create beauty in small ways in our lives, and I call it inflicting joy on other people as much as possible. And I really appreciate your humor, Vinny, in this interview. It's made it a lot easier to talk about what I want to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I always said that if you want to kind of, almost like the darkness of this world is kind of like a barrel full of water and you're sticking your head into it and you can't breathe in there and what have you. Mm-hmm. Having humor is like a scuba tank.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a really good analogy. I like that.
It allows you to breathe underwater. It allows you to see light through the dark. It is the antithesis, and it's really, really valuable. And you notice that the humor of the elite is very, very different from the humor of people like you and I.
They
they don't laugh with you. They laugh at you.
Exactly.
And only at you.
Mm-hmm. It's all about ego and arrogance. Yeah. Whereas, you know, the humor of this applies to the art as well. You were talking about the country music. The humor and the art of people who live kind of in the dregs and in the deeper places is so much richer, and it's much more about empathy and compassion.
Mm. When I was... Here's an interesting story. You know, my first employment was writing, directing, and producing my own play.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And I was 19 years old, and all of my friends were a bit younger than I, 14, 15, 16, 17, you know, that kind of thing. And they were, incidentally, all the best young actors in the small little town that I was working on. So I got them all together, got them to rehearse. This is on summer holidays and what have you, just after I'd finished high school. And what occurred to me was that it's actually really, really hard to organize other people to get your vision. All right, you know, this is my vision, but I need other people to fulfill it. However, I said that there's only one point of success. It's not necessarily the money that I will get from this play so that I can go to university. That was my entire point of doing it. It wasn't necessarily whether or not my friends appreciated me after the fact. I'm no longer in contact with any of them at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was about making somebody cry, make them feel something. Mm-hmm. Feel something real, and I did, and that was something that I've defined as the one point where you know that a piece of art has been effective and works for what it is used for. Okay,
absolutely.
If you can make somebody cry, if you can physically induce a response based upon people's empathy, that is the pinnacle of the success of any artwork, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more.
Mm-hmm. If you can't get that real painful emotion through to people, if you can't get them to really feel it, you're not making anything of value.
Well, you know, art and all of that really that you're talking about, just it taps into our humanity. This is what it means to be human. And, you know, we're losing so much of that. And so to bring that back is part of the transformation of our species that I see really needing to happen.
Do you believe we're on the cusp of a renaissance?
On the one hand, yeah. On the other hand, I mean, I think it's a real both and thing again. Mm. I think we're going to have to go deep, deep, deep into darkness on this planet. We may be facing near-term extinction by mid-century. I don't know. But I think there are going to be pockets of places where people will survive, and there will be opportunity to create an entirely next culture that is completely different from this one.
Evolved, in other words.
Yeah, and evolved as a result of suffering. That's where real evolution happens, is out of our suffering.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is the self-discovery. I think it's as you have traumas and pain in your life, you start to recognize what it is you're capable of actually...
Yes.
Happening to you and surviving, right?
Yes.
Have you ever seen that Disney movie Aladdin?
I think I did, yeah, a few years ago. Refresh my memory.
Okay. There's a part in it where Jafar, the evil villain and what have you, he gets turned into a genie. He wishes the genie to turn him into the most powerful genie in the world. And... he then turns into this genie, and he's about to kill him and everything like that. And the good genie says, "Don't worry, bro. He's a genie. He can't kill anybody." And then he gets blasted with flame, and he goes, "Ah! But you'll be surprised what you can live through." And that's kind of what I think is so powerful and really important about growing up and just living life itself, is just knowing what it is that you're capable of living through.
Absolutely. I totally agree.
I think that's what gives you the appreciation for life itself.
You bet.
All right. Well, it's been emotional. And somewhat fabulous. And
well, you felt something, huh?
Yeah, I did indeed. And I want to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Maybe somewhere near the cockles, maybe above the cockles. Some, I don't know. But
could I just give you a little screenshot of my book, "Collapsing Consciously: Transformative Truths for Turbulent Times"?
Absolutely. The show's kind of like a bathtub. It doesn't work very well without a plug.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah. We got it. We got that. We got everything sussed. And I just want to thank you not only for your time and sharing this with me and your expertise and your wisdom, but just in general, I appreciate the person that you are and what it is that you do and why you do it.
Thank you so much, Vinny, and thank you for having me on the show.
No worries. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. Archives are at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com with many, many interviews. It occurs to me that my radio career has spanned 5 years already. Yeah. I was like looking at that this morning. I was like, yes! I mean, it's not technically 5 years, you know. It's only like a little over 3.5, you know, kind of thing. But never mind. Through the end of 2010, through the start of 2014, technically that's 5 years spanned.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I was quite proud of that. And, yeah, sometimes you do just have to stop doing what you're doing and just look back at what it is you've accomplished.
Yes, indeed.
Sometimes you've got to appreciate what you have in order to know that you've really come a long way. Thank you very much, Carolyn, and you have yourself a lovely evening.
You too, Vinny. Bye-bye.
You are only exception. You are.